This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Hi, folks. I just wanted to start this episode by giving a shout out to the fervent few, our subscriber community, who has been supporting us over the last 6 months with their subscription costs coming in on a monthly recurring basis. We're now over 250 subscribers, which is constituting about a third of our overall operating costs for the editorial site, goodbeerhunting.com. We never thought we would see that kind of input from our subscriber community. We certainly didn't expect it to be as voracious and as engaged as it is. Getting a monthly donation is one thing, having people in a forum and communicating ideas and sharing their thoughts and advising on sort of the future direction of where things go. It's been more than we ever could have hoped for, certainly more than we thought we would receive by opening up that channel. And it's made a huge difference. It's been a game changer for us. Not only is it monetarily supporting our content, but we now have this great engaged audience that we're talking to every day with our entire team. And it's been thrilling. And it's making so many of the things that you're seeing on GBH that are new possible. So thank you to the fervent few. And if you would like to join, if you would like to become a paying member of GBH's readership, helping contribute to the independence of our team, our financials, reducing the amount of advertising that we will ever have to take on, which has always been minimal, but we'd like to keep it that way, we'd love your support. You can join us by going to patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. And if you do that, even in a small way, you're contributing to a huge difference in the future of our writing. Okay, on to today's episode. This past fall, when myself and Hillary Schuster, our experienced director, were in London for the Beavertown Extravaganza and Uppers and Downers, we were thrilled to get outside the city for a couple of days to visit one of my favorite cider makers in the world, Tom Oliver. He was pouring at the Extravaganza, of course, right next to Other Half, which made me laugh a bit as I entered, seeing dozens of people rightly waiting in line for Other Half's beers. And then next to that, a nearly empty line for Oliver's ciders, which I would put up against any wild ale, lambic, goose in the world in terms of its fermentation complexity, its sort of natural rustic condition, and agricultural qualities. It's really one of the most fantastic fermented beverages you can buy anywhere. And at the fest, you could just walk right up to his booth and get a pour, because we still have a strange relationship with cider. In the US, we have a strange tension between these artisanal orchard-based producers like Oliver and the quote-unquote craft cider makers selling quick fermentation in a six-pack of cans, some even produced by breweries themselves as an alternative offering. That also exists in the UK, but the biggest tension there is among the sort of history of country cider known as scrumpy, which is maybe more akin to moonshine in the US, and the mass market ciders called white ciders, which people drink for its functional benefits, not so much its flavors. Cider makers like Tom Oliver have a hard time cutting through, but it's improving. Tom's ciders are rebranded beautifully this year, which is getting some notice. And as more and more beer drinkers follow their palates into more complex cider fermentations, they're finding something resonant in mixed fermentation beers, natural wines, and maybe, finally, orchard-based ciders. So we went out to Tom's multi-generational family farm in Herefordshire near the Welsh border and stayed for a couple of days to get the lay of the land. We ate meat pies and drank some beautiful things and toured the countryside, and eventually myself and our UK editor, Matthew Curtis, sat down in the dining room of Tom's cottage to talk about the future. This is Tom Oliver of Oliver's Cider and Perry. Listen in. Thank you for bringing us out to lovely Hereford.
It's an absolute pleasure, Michael.
In the middle of Herefordshire.
It is. And yet I think you're pronouncing it really quite well for an American. they struggle a little bit with Herefordshire, but you're doing a very good job.
Okay. Yeah, I've had a couple of days practice.
Yeah.
It's beautiful out here in the country. I mean, they call it the country, but there's also a good-sized town here.
It's a good-sized town. It has a cathedral.
Is that that designates a good-sized town?
It doesn't necessarily, but there aren't many very small towns with a cathedral.
You've got your own. yesterday we spent going around the farm and the orchard. The various orchards that you work with and manage and pull fruit from.
Yes.
Give us a sense of, I guess, the various pieces of both the farm and the cider business and how that all works together, because it's a little bit of a network.
Yes. We're a small mixed family farm in Herefordshire, and that means that we have lots of different things going on at different times of the year. So the year has to cater for 300 Texel sheep and lambing them, and then getting the fat lambs away to market. We also have a 50-head Hereford herd of cattle, which will take a single calf off each year. And then in amongst all that, we'll be growing some corn to feed to the sheep and cattle. We have a lot of grassland, and we have a few small orchards. Because I only have a few small orchards, I also have to get my fruit from other suppliers. So I've got a sort of nice little network of people.
Kind of scattered around the countryside.
Scattered around Herefordshire. And there are some people that I help with their orchard management. And in return, we get the fruit. And that works really well. There are other people that grow fruit specifically for me, which is great. And then there's just people who have fruit and like to bring it in every year. Mm. And out of all that, we try and make sure that we get sufficient fruit every year to make the cider we want to make.
Yeah, I was struck yesterday when you were discussing kind of the nature of the farm and how it's managed by the different family members, because you all have very different roles. I think you described your mother, who's in her 80s now. She still tends to some of the sheep. Those are kind of her domain.
Yes.
And your brother runs the farming aspect of it.
Yes.
And you very much manage the cider. And that all kind of works together as still somewhat of a family business there.
It does. It does. It's nice. It's nice that we've had the freedom within a very small setup to be able to concentrate on the things that we think we do well. And it gives each individual a real drive, I think, to focus on the aspects that are best for them. But it doesn't mean that you can get out of doing just the sheer old good old hard work when it needs to be done.
Cider being kind of the newest piece of that to bolt on, and it's replacing probably one of the most lucrative aspects that you used to have, which was actually hop production.
Yeah,
you were making a lot of Fuggles.
Yes. When I was a lad, we had 38 acres of Fuggles hops, and they were by far and away the most significant cash crop that we had. And I grew up hoping, I think, that hop growing would be the future. It didn't turn out like that. At the end of the 1900s, we couldn't make sense of it anymore, financially and in other ways.
Which is odd timing, considering that overall hops have become quite the sought-after ingredient in beer making, yeah, but not necessarily the ones that you were growing and not necessarily from England. Yeah. It's gone elsewhere.
Yeah, it did. There were a few issues, labor, the actual general hop market for UK hops, and also for Fuggles, Verticillium wilt. That was starting to creep through the crop, and the thought that overnight what looked like a promising hop yard could be taken by the wilt does really start to play on
the
you.
The wilt being a disease that goes from...
Yeah. And then literally it's a 24-hour thing. So it was unsettling, to say the least. And I think in terms of hops, maybe if we, you know, you could say if we'd looked to the future, to the right varieties, but it would have been a long period of many years before we'd have got back into making money from it. And I don't think we were able to sustain that. So
yeah, you would have had to transition from being sort of a traditional farmer of hops to almost a geneticist.
Yes.
In order to stay ahead of the diseases.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's very much what's happening out in Yakima Valley is people are working very hard and spending a load of money to stay ahead of those things. Because it used to be based in New York is where our hop growing region used to be until disease just wiped it out.
Right.
And it wasn't until it popped up again in California that we had a viable production of it again.
Okay.
So now we're at risk again.
Yeah. I know that when we started to realize that the productivity that was possible from certain parts of the states, you know, at the beginning of the 2000s, we were nothing but envious, I would say, and jealous, because it took a while for disease to make an inroad into a lot of these new hop yards. And until then, it was a fantastic opportunity for American hop growers. Though, of course, it does at some stage come home to roost and, and problems manifest themselves. So.
You still have some of the hops just kind of growing around the property. They're just kind of infiltrating like kudzu over the trees and the bushes now. I mean, they don't even look like hop vines. They're just growing laterally.
I think we've got two of the most indulged hop vines I've ever seen, really. They're about 30 foot long and creaking everywhere. But
still producing some beautiful aromas off of those.
They were.
Things.
When we rubbed them yesterday, they did. They
exploded had some, in the hand.
Yeah. It was fantastic. It's the same old thing. So it goes to show there's nothing like being somewhere where a crop is naturally suited to grow in and then just being able to rub it firsthand. It's fantastic.
I should mention that Matthew Curtis is here with us. It's silently sitting by because I forgot to introduce him.
It's okay.
You were enamored with the Fuggles that we were rubbing yesterday.
I was fascinated because British hops have such a bad reputation as being earthy and boring and twiggy is the term that gets used so often for them. But these were, I assume they were wild Fuggles or they were...
They were of something.
They were something, but they tasted smelled of lemon verbena, and it was incredible. Mm. And I don't know why British hops have such a bad rap. As a result, I would have loved to see how they imparted some flavours and aromas in a beer.
Yeah, if only we could grow more of them, we might try.
Now, when you were making the decision to end the hop production on the farm and pick up cider as a potential replacement, what were some of the nerves that you might have had about such a dramatic switch? Because, I mean, that's a big move for a farm to make that kind of a switch.
It is. I think it's, to say it was easy, it isn't the case, but the decision was made for us. The ability to make the hops profitable was not there anymore. The challenges were too great. So we reluctantly accepted that was the case. Then for me, it just gave me some time back at a time of year, the autumn and the early autumn. After hop picking, I didn't really ever feel like going out and doing anything in a big way. So making cider was just for our own pleasure. Mm-hmm. But when hop picking wasn't on the horizon, it gave us the whole autumn. And so that's everything seemed much more possible then. I didn't have any grand master plan. I just wanted to start selling cider.
Mm-hmm. How would you compare the cider you were making then as almost a hobbyist kind of vein to the ciders that you're making now?
I think they're very similar. The process and everything is very, very similar. The joy of small-scale cider making is that you can be fastidious about every single aspect of it to a degree that is nigh on impossible when you start growing. And so there are many, many pluses, I think, for remaining small-scale. To be honest, I don't really think we're anything other than small-scale plus now. There's that ability to concentrate on individual things when it's small is great, but also there is, in terms of cider making, I think, quite a number of good things that come with increased volume, in terms of just fermentations, etc. So,
yeah, let's talk about the operation because I think any one of the dozen or so things that we saw yesterday would be a big enough X factor for one producer. Like that would give them the character that they're looking for, whether we're talking about how the barrels are filled and aged and where, or if we're talking about the particular orchards, of which we saw many.
Right.
Any one of those would have been enough to add character and distinction to most of the cider makers that I'm familiar with. But for you, you've somehow tangled all of these X factors together into something pretty robust in the way that it creates character. Let's start with the first orchard that we stopped at, which I believe had two apples there, Dabinet and then the other one, which I can't remember the name of.
Michelin.
Could you describe that as a As an orchard that should, I mean, it basically should not still be producing.
Yes.
It's long past its lifespan.
Yeah.
And yet that's one of your main sources.
It is. It is. It's an orchard at the top of my road. Used to belong to a friend of mine and has recently been sold to some new friends of mine. It was one of the first bush orchards that Bulmers Cider, and for those that listening that don't know about Bulmers Cider, they are the largest cider producers in the world, have been for many, many years, now owned by Heineken, but still based in terms of the cider making in Herefordshire, and by far and away the biggest consumers of cider apples that are grown in this county. This is an orchard that it used to, the fruit used to go exclusively to them, but about 14 or so years ago, I started using it, and it's an orchard that when it was planted 50 years ago was given a 30-year time span.
And that was based on its economic viability more than anything.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And they also thought that maybe the, yes, and that meant that they thought the trees would be past their best in terms of productivity by then. But as in so many cases, these trees have proved to be much more productive over a longer period. And so 20 years after their supposed demise, they're still as strong and as healthy as ever.
And not passively. I mean, you've essentially had to reset how that orchard is,
yes,
managed.
So 14 years ago, we took it into a no-spray regime and no-fertilizer regime. So no inputs. Allowed the natural ecology to develop in the orchard. Just looking at the trees yesterday, the only thing that we've really concentrated on is the pruning aspect of it. A very good friend of mine says here, you are farming light and air when it comes to growing apples. And that's one thing that is very obvious in the orchard. The light and the air can get to every apple.
You do that by bringing the height down some.
Yeah, we've brought the height down a bit.
Controlling the width of them between the rows.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's been done in recent years by mechanical means, which is something that if someone had said to me 10 years ago, oh, that's the way you'll be pruning it, I'd have said, not a hope in hell. But that's the way it's gone, and it's proved to be very, very good. It's a good year this year. It's an on year, but the crop is beautifully distributed through the trees. They're obviously looking very well. There's no signs of any disease.
I think the only thing we saw was the mistletoe,
yes,
having a run at a few of the trees.
Yes,
that was new to me. Can you explain what the mistletoe situation is about? I had no idea that this was sort of a parasitic.
Yes. So the mistletoe is something that is traditionally a lovely sort of Christmas decoration in houses around here and all over the country, really, with its white berries, and birds like it. And it's for centuries, it seemed to have almost a saprophytic relationship with orchards. You know, it would be there, we'd get the berries off it, decorate the house at Christmas, all lovely, lovely. But in the last few years, there's been, as I understand it, a more aggressive form of mistletoe that have come in. And they're basically killing off orchards and trees. So you need to be really quite proactive now in removing mistletoe.
Well, it was really fascinating to see it visually because it was almost indistinguishable in the way that it rooted into the branches themselves with its own sort of armature that looks like the tree. And you were describing that as like it works its way back through the arm.
Yes. You have to prune very, very heavily to get rid of it. So take the whole branch or limb, as it would be, away, right back to the main trunk, to have any chance of getting on top of it.
And I think you blame the French for that.
Yes, yes, yes. The old enemy. We blame them for a lot of things. We don't mean it. We love them, really.
And then we went to another orchard. Your friend Simon, was it?
Yes, Simon Dent.
And there we saw a variety of operations just even within his own land there. We saw one that you described as kind of the new way of farming Perry.
Yeah.
Yes. Perry pears.
Yes.
And then we saw some somewhat ancient Perry trees in this like sort of scattered grove. And then, of course, we saw an apple orchard that's coming online that you'll be taking most of the fruit from.
Yes.
So there was a variety of fields there that all have a different purpose for you.
Yes. It's a lovely opportunity on one small farm to see all these different aspects of fruit growing. I described the Perry side of it as the three ages of Perry. So you can see the very youthful and young, almost... It's more than just bush, really. Now they're really quite small trees, and they're growing in close, and the varieties are being chosen as best we can for the appropriate varieties for that style of growing. And it's a big 10-acre site, and it looks very impressive. Not as impressive as it would if it hadn't had a tough frost and a very poor pollinating season. The crop's not amazing on it this year, but you can walk 100 meters north of that orchard and you see the middle-aged orchard of 50 years old on what in a way are sort of standards or semi-standard trees, and the crop on there is absolutely fantastic. Just 100 meters difference, and no problems with frost, and no pollinating problems, which is very interesting.
And one of those fields, I think you described as being one of the largest in the world.
Well,
in the way that it was done, the
bush, the first one, the 10 acres of bush Perry pears. There are not many 10-acre plots of bush Perry.
Yeah, maybe
pears.
A dozen or so. You said.
Yeah. So that's quite a sight. And at blossom time, it's superb.
A big reason for that is likely due to the commercial viability of Perry, which is still a fraction of a percentage point on the market compared to something like cider, which is much more sought after and traditional in the UK.
Yes, the market for Perry is still being worked on. It's had periods when it's blossomed, and other times when the confidence in it has deteriorated, or the competition from other products has knocked Perry. But it's a glorious drink, and we need to make sure that we reestablish it as such.
Yeah, I mean, at the higher end, where your Perrys certainly fall, it can be perceived and drank and enjoyed in the same way that you can any sort of high-end cider.
Yeah.
But in the middle of the market, a Perry is sort of seen differently than cider sometimes. It doesn't necessarily have the same tradition or culture around it, maybe.
I think so. It's for anyone in the market, the situation has been confused recently in the UK with the advent of initially pear cider and then fruit ciders. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, the sort of drinker who would have enjoyed a Perry has maybe been persuaded to try pear cider or fruit cider. And
when you say fruit cider, you mean things like a black currant cider, or in the States it's blueberries and raspberries and things like that, where they're basically using the cider as a base for the sweetness and then flavoring it in different directions.
Yes, yes. I don't think anything like a co-ferment or anything. It's just a flavoring.
Yeah.
And that has taken, I think, quite a substantial amount of the market sales opportunities for Perry away. And we need to reestablish the might of the Perry.
Yeah, it's one of the unique examples, I think, where the uneducated customer for Perry was accidentally almost drinking a really nice handcrafted sort of, you know, natural product whether they cared or not.
Yes.
But because they didn't necessarily care, they were very vulnerable to being distracted by other things that are made mostly just flavorings.
Yes.
Because they were mostly drinking Perry as an alternative to cider. Anytime a product is an alternative to something, it's very vulnerable to bastardization, really. In the U.S., cider is almost being used that way, as an alternative to beer. Like, we have all these six-pack ciders in a can now that are okay products. You know, they're probably just getting some cheap concentrate in a lot of cases and making, apple-tasting semi-sweet ciders in a can and treating it as a craft product as an alternative, gluten-free or, beer for non-beer people in a way. And now we're starting to see some weird distractions from that as well. So it makes it very vulnerable.
Yeah, you expressed it perfectly there. I thought, the average drinker probably did not appreciate the qualities and the skills that went into making the Perry. So we need to make sure that people do.
They certainly do with the ciders. I mean, for the most part, there's a long, long tradition of cider making in the UK that's very respected, even if it's sometimes seen as country-ish, right? Or the scrumpies and those things. But people take it very seriously.
Yes.
There's a long sort of tradition of talking about and making cider.
There is. And we're very proud of the periods in history where cider has obviously reached a predominant position. It may be possibly going back to the 1600s when, because of warring situations with our fellow Europeans, the wine didn't get through, ships weren't sailing, etc. Cider really stepped up to the plate then. And it does frequently through history, and I think nowadays it's doing the same again.
One of the other orchards that were there for the Perrys, the Perry Pears, was kind of a grove that was fenced off that had, each tree almost was a completely different pear tree. And I know that you've actually been working to figure out what some of those pears are, because they're kind of beyond what most geneticists would be able to call on site. Just by looking at them, you've had to do some work to figure out where they even come from.
Yes. It's identifying old varieties of Perry pears is quite a challenge. Sometimes they look very similar to varieties that are grown in the modern day, but they might, on just one small aspect of the characteristic of the pear, a physical characteristic, they might just not match up. And sometimes it's because they have developed their own identity in a particular locality, so developed a sport of something, or they genuinely are just nothing like any other variety. So we've made some progress with these. We're having there are a number of trees in that particular orchard that look very, very much like Blakeney Red. Taste sort of like Blakeney Red, but there is a difference. But we're getting them DNA tested to see if they are, Blakeney Reds from 150, 200 years ago. And if genetically that's what they are, then we know that they are Blakeneys, but maybe just, once again, a different sport of Blakeney or something like that.
And then sometimes it comes down to just one tree. You've got a Copley Perry that you make that all comes, it's about 1,000 bottles from one tree.
Yes.
Which has, that's about as distinctive as it gets.
It is. It's a distinctive Perry in itself. With a lovely sort of floral confectionery aroma. It's, for me, it's a bit like opening the door of an old-fashioned sweet shop and getting a lovely waft of pineapple chunk. And there's a load of citrus in there as well. It's great. But this particular tree, it's in an orchard near Bromyard in Herefordshire. And on the Herefordshire-Worcestershire border in the 1890s, there's written records of at least 2 10-acre orchards of this particular one variety of Perry pear, the Copley. And we've been to that particular farm where those orchards are recorded, and there's not a single fruit tree left let alone a copy peri pear tree left. So the hunt was on to find this particular lost variety. And a friend of mine, Janet Whittle, at the Three Horseshoes at Little Cowan, said, I've got some friends who've got a few pear trees. Perhaps you'd be interested in the pears. And this was probably, 15-something years ago. And I said, oh, yes, please. And along I went and picked the pears for the first year, made peri from them. And it was lovely peri. Each of those, there's five trees that I really like there. In each of them make a wonderful peri. But this one particular tree, when it cropped, was particularly nice. So we go every year, and some years it had no fruit, other years it would have a stack of fruit. And I remember at some stage about 10 years ago thinking, you know what, this fruit looks really like something that I've read about. And so I looked through the books, and I thought, you know what, it's really like the copy. So I thought, well, I won't say anything, wait another year, look at it again, identify, go through the identification process again. And it looked really good. So I then got in touch with Charles Martel, who's the very well-known cheesemaker, makes the Stinking Bishop, which is a cheese that's it's soaked in peri. The rind is soaked in peri. So we keep the peri theme going. And he says, well, you know, please, you know, take me to the tree, show me the tree. So you do what all good peri pear makers do. You blindfold someone, you drive around in circles for an hour, and then you lead them by the hand into the field and take the blindfold off. And he thought, this looks just like the tree as we would expect. But what we then had to do was take some budwood from it, grow on another tree, take the fruit from the next tree, next generation tree, then identify that. Anyway, over a period of time, we all agreed that this was indeed the copy tree. And so as far as I know, I know where the only mature tree of this variety is, though I'm happy to say there are now dozens and dozens of baby copy peri pear trees growing all around the county, or maybe elsewhere as well.
One thing that springs to mind from when we were driving around looking at the orchards yesterday was when you were looking at these older trees and you just sort of muttered, oh, I'm glad it's not me that has to harvest them. And it seems like a lot of work preserving these heritage varieties of pear when you've got such good young crops as well. So what's the importance of maintaining these heritage varieties of pears and apples? Okay.
So it is a great point. For me, there's no doubt in my mind that while a tree is developing its character and getting older, the fruit from the younger trees is not really of the same qualities as you get from these older trees. And once again, I think, Michael, you expressed it really well yesterday, that everything responds positively to a good bit of stress. And that's certainly the case. I think older trees that are not given the benefit of big inputs in terms of fertilizers and are made to fend for themselves, get the, you know, make the use of the nature as it's intended, so the water and the sun and all that, if the tree can be challenged, the fruit that will come from it will probably help make a better cider or peri with more character.
It's just like people, really.
Yeah.
It's just a metaphor. It's nothing to do with any tree knowledge.
That's it. Stick them behind a microphone and get them to make some sense.
That's right. It'll be fruitful. GBH is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Guinness, our first major underwriter, is helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the U.S. in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports and following their journey to our shores. We're thrilled to be digging into these stories, and like this podcast and many of our other projects, Coming to America wouldn't be possible without our underwriting support from companies like Guinness. Watch for more underwriters and new themes like Coming to America in the coming months. We're also supported by The Fervent Few, our growing community of GBH fans and readers, including some professional supporters like Cloudwater Brewing Company from Manchester, Four Pier Brewing from London, The Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Sound Growler Brewing from Tinley Park, Illinois, Magic Rock from Huddersfield, England, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, and Beer Hawk, all from the UK, Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter, as well as recent additions from 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York State, and Signal Hill Products from Cape Town, South Africa, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. It was fascinating to me how, in most orchard-based ciders that I've gotten to know and understood the operation of, it was very much like a controlled sort of sequence of controlling the orchard and then controlling the fermentation. And it was it was all sort of within the hand of the person making it. And it's very much still true, I think, of your situation, but you've stitched together this little network of orchards that are on other people's property. And I like how you described, you know, my old friends used to own that orchard and now my new friends own it. It's almost like you came with the sale. you can buy this house, but you have to take the cider maker with you. there's just a really interesting sort of kind of community-based resourcing happening there to keep, not just to take advantage of these things that exist, but to keep them going in a direction that makes them viable for the future as well. Yeah. Otherwise, they would just sort of wither and disappear or go or get really gnarly and become unusable. Yeah. Or
I'm really reliant on people, orchard owners who really get what I'm trying to do and get what it's going to take from them, because I'm not going to offer them untold riches. The best I can offer them is, I think, some of the great cider and perry that we make in return, if that's what they want. If not, it's money. But as I say, it won't be huge amounts of money. But I need people to really buy into what I need the orchards to be, the way they need to be looked after. So I want them at best to be grazed. That's the ultimate for me.
Explain what grazed means.
Okay, so let stock run underneath the trees.
Yeah, cows and sheep.
Yeah, cattle and sheep, basically. And because I think that's the most natural and best way for keeping the grass under control and for just putting a little bit of manure back in the ground. But also, it's the most natural way for the farms to run, for things to be viable. Orchards have to be multi-use situations. Yeah,
you're using the same plot of land for multiple things.
Yeah. So it's a different style of fruit growing, from bush orchards and intensive growing. It's a traditional orchard where the orchard has to have as many uses as possible. That's one of the things. So in order to do that, they have to be prepared to fence it properly, have to have water supplies laid on, they have to be able to get the animals in and out as required. It takes work and it takes attention to detail, and so that's good. They also need to be able to see that I don't necessarily want to take all the fruit. I want to take the best fruit. So we're going to leave the rotten ones and bits and pieces behind. And a lot of people want land cleared completely, but I don't want to do that. I only want to take the best. So there's all the time you're asking people, this is what I want out of it. Can you work with me on this? And slowly over time, all the people that I work with have, go along with this. So it's really good.
And having lived your whole life here and farmed, and worked with the cider apples that way, you still get calls from people who say, I've got a small orchard over here, and you'd never seen it before. Yeah. And then it's up to you to call on that and to assess it. And to see if there's some value there that you can extract from the orchard itself for everybody.
Yes.
It's amazing to me that there are still apple trees anywhere in this entire shire growing that you have not already seen.
There's a huge amount that I've probably never seen and probably never will, probably jealously guarded by other cider makers who want to keep the grapefruit for themselves, as I would. Quite often around here, land changes hands, not that frequently, but if it does, quite often the new owners are very keen to see things used as best as possible. So they quite often get in touch. And I've had two phone calls this morning from someone with a small peri-pear orchard in a place I never knew there was a peri-pear orchard. I really enjoy going and seeing them. Are always keen to try and give people hope about use of the fruit. But sometimes, you know, the fruit's not appropriate fruit for cider making, or it's in an impossible location to extricate the fruit. You know, we have to consider the physical aspect of this sometimes. It was great when these orchards were planted and you were making cider on the property, but actually taking it away from the property. People come and the only access to what is a small orchard now is through their front gate and the garden and all that. And there's, you know, you, we're not going to wheel
you
out.
We're
not going to get a wheelbarrow in. And that's
now there's a pretty healthy culture of cider making in Herefordshire of almost at the homebrew level. Like there, what you're describing is like that orchard was to make cider for that family at one time.
Yes.
And maybe some of the employees that worked on the farm or something. And there's still a copious amount of people who are making ciders in that vein. But in competitions, of which there are many, you're going head to head with those kinds of cider makers, and they give you a run for your money, I would imagine.
It's great fun. There's a particular competition that we were talking about yesterday. It's the Big Apple, and that is a marvelous celebration of all things cider and perry and apple. Similar in many ways to Franklin County Cider Days in Massachusetts, and it happens twice a year. And at the spring blossom time one, there's a competition in every maker, whether large, small, or
commercial,
big,
or
commercial,
or
non-commercial, or just for pleasure, can enter ciders, and we all the makers are the judges. And I have to say that more often than not, it's a smaller producer who nobody's in a way ever heard of, as it were, who will make the best cider. And it's great. Everyone has a fairly merry day by the end of it. And you get to talk to people and exchange stories, but most importantly, drink cider.
One of the things that you said yesterday that struck me is why that's possible, why a small sort of home cider maker could compete with somebody that's doing it commercially, is similar in a sense, maybe in proportion to the way that you described the kinds of ciders you make compared to mass market ciders. I think you said something along the lines of everything they're trying to strip out of their cider in terms of character is what I'm trying to get in there.
I think, you know, the key for me to cider making is that you must do your absolute best to express the fruit as well as you can. And whether that's a particular cider that you think works very well for just one variety of apple, or whether it's the necessity to blend lots of different apples together to create a cider that's got the character that you want. But it's the apple that will give you the character. And there's only two other things that really, for me, give the character that I would want, and that's the yeast and what the yeast gives you and its byproducts, and then maybe the container you ferment in. And, you know, if you use wood, you're going to get whatever the characters you're going to pull from the wood, and the nature of fermentation in wood, which is another set of characters. Or if you go to a tank, plastic or stainless, you're going to get a relatively neutral fermentation environment. So you'll focus back to the apple and the yeast. Mm-hmm. And that's the two keys for me.
Yeah, I mean, so we started out by talking about how many X factors there were. We haven't even gotten to the fermentation side yet. We've just been talking about how variable the orchards and the particular trees in some of those orchards are, and the kind of fruit you get from there. But in your operation, you were fermenting in a variety of vessels, both in material and size. You had plastic and steel and wood. And even within those, you had variables, yes, of size and shape and particular materials. Describe on the wood side. I know you get a variety of barrels, and you've developed some preference for yourself over time of which ones you feel like really add some character to your ciders.
Yes, because we're not a volume cider makers in the strictest sense. My preference is for lots of small containers. To give you as wide a palette when it comes to blending as possible. So the standard sort of barrel of the 220 liter size is great for us. We use about 120 of those. And I've a big liking for rum barrels. If anyone can get me any, I'd be very pleased. And I think they're especially good for perry. I'm very happy with good spirit barrels coming from whiskey, but I don't want smoky peaty whiskey barrels. They just destroy a cider as far as I'm concerned. Anything in terms of sherry, cognac, Calvados, I'd be very happy to have those barrels. Wine, if they're really fresh, red wine are great. Not so keen on, well, no one's ever really offered me white wine barrels, so.
So who knows?
But my gut feeling is probably big no. So yeah, those are the sort of barrels that I like to use.
Why would you suspect no on the white wine barrels? Help me understand what the factors in your mind.
It's just a gut feeling. I think I do know that they won't make great vessels for fermenting cider in, but maybe they would. Maybe someone will prove me wrong. If they'll give me some barrels, I'll try.
There it is. Now the place that you're aging these in, the barrels pretty much stay in place.
Yes.
You fill them and empty them where they're at. Yes. You're not racking them and moving them around and whatnot.
No.
They're in the old hop kilns.
I think it's important for you, as you've seen with your own eyes, is that we are a no forklift area in terms of where the barrels are. So we literally just have to push them in.
Yeah, you physically wouldn't be able to do it any other way.
No. That's not to say that I wouldn't be averse to a very nice modern building where the forklift could take some of the work out of it, but it would probably lose a little bit of its oldie-worldy charm. But it might save my back, or Yarek's back anyway.
But the rooms that they're in are the old hop kiln rooms.
Yes.
And, I mean, as much as any lambic or goose producer has some toar coming from the spider webs in the corners, these certainly do.
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure how much I should say, really, but it's, you know, we've been talking about a living environment and everything having its own ecology. Mm-hmm. And certainly I think our barrel rooms operate along a similar line. There's four areas. One is quite sort of almost airy and light and a touch warmer when it is warm. I think one room's quite sort of dry and neutral. There's a corridor that's relatively dry and fairly neutral as well. And then there's a sort of fourth, sort of dank, musty, damp room. So, you know, three really quite distinctive environments for barrels. Mm-hmm. You can utilize those environments to your advantage, or alternatively, you can find out you may have probably should have made a decision to put that particular perry in a different room. Maybe would have been a good thing, but you try and put the right liquid in the right place.
Yeah. And you sort of, so it becomes a bit of a library, really, it seems to me, of different ciders and perries and different barrels and how you manage those in your mind. How do you decide when something is right for blending or perhaps right for its own bottle as a single source?
For the way we work, everything is done on taste. So I am I'm a very, very poor scientist. And I need to be more of a scientist. I'm intending to become more of a scientist. But up until now, everything is done on taste. So we will, at particular times of the year, go through and taste everything we have. And for us, it would start in January, just prior to when we start lambing. We would taste through all the barrels from a particular year. And that will be with a view to putting together the vintage cider. So this year, we tasted through all the 2015 cider barrels that we had and did, for the first time ever, actually, a team tasting. I normally do it on my own with Yarrick and Dave. And we arrive at the blend for the vintage every year. But this year, team tasting, and we had the combined palettes of a number of people, which was a lot of fun. Stu McKinley from Yeasty Boys had expressed a great interest in the big tannic flavors from our vintage cider. So he came up and joined us. Johnny Bright from Hereford Beer House joined us. Susanna Forbes from Little Pomona Cidery up the road joined us. And Polly, a wonderful champagne cider maker from Devon, joined us from Find Ciders. And Yarrick, Dave, and me. So
you made a big event out of it.
It was a great day. I think we made a great cider too. You seemed to enjoy it yesterday. So, but that's how we taste through with a view to the cider or the perry that we're intending to make. Over the years, you tend to have an idea when something should be ready or would be ready, and we'll go ahead and make it.
And a good bit of the ciders that you put into bottle are, I think you said they were a blend of. Okay. Those fermentation vessels, wood and plastic and steel, which was interesting to me. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah. The vintage is entirely barrel fermented cider. But the in general, there's probably about a 30% barrel cider and blended with 70% tank cider. Tank cider is a little more straightforward, a little more focused. In its flavor profile, the wood can be a little more characterful and more random. And I think generally, the more mainstream your ciders get, the less wood is in them. So we tend to think that's roughly how the balance works out.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's almost the way a painter might mix colors is. Yeah. You're just trying to add a little bit to see what it can, where it takes that sort of more straightforward flavor and adds a sort of edge to it potentially to keep it interesting.
Yeah. I think you know, we try and make ciders that got little hints of lots of things so that nothing predominates, but it all works to give character, in a harmonious setting so that's what we're trying to do.
You touched on how you collaborated with a few different folks for your vintage blend there, including Stu from Yeasty Boys and Johnny from Hereford Beer House. But you've also been collaborating with some craft brewers in the UK recently, most notably Mills Brewing, yes. The Foxpick, and Brew by Numbers, who you've done a sort of Saison Perry, which is very enjoyable.
Yes.
What's the value to you in collaborating with these relatively young craft breweries?
Yeah. I think the value is one, the fantastic taste sensations that we think we can come up with by collaborating. And I think it's also a huge dose of energy that I get from the brewers that I've worked with. The brewing world and the world of craft, I say in inverted commas, beer, as I've just witnessed at the fantastic Beavertown extravaganza that we were all at last weekend. Mm. You know, cider is nowhere near that world at the moment in terms of the attention it draws and the energy it has and the desire from customers for trying all these wonderful different beers and experiences that they can get. You know, it was a real stimulation for me to see that desire for beer and for all things new and for to try all the different creations that were coming up. So for me, one of the great things we can do is by working with brewers is get a little bit of that energy and bring it through from beer to cider. And the fact that you can create and try and stimulate the palate with a collaborative approach is something that I think we should really value.
How was the Beavertown extravaganza for you? Because you were right next to Other Half and they had queues for as long as they had beer pouring. Did you find that, obviously you got to try their beers because you were standing next to them, but did you find anyone from that queue was looking at you going, I'm curious about the cider, I'm going to wander over there and try that next? And what kind of reaction were you getting from an audience that was just beer fans?
Yeah, it was a remarkable opportunity to do a couple of things. The first was where there's a queue, there's potential. So that our helpers, we were armed with two things, which was fantastic of Beavertown to allow us to do this. And the first major weapon we had was bottles. So armed with a bottle, we could go up and down lines offering people cider while they waited. Now, that's not going to be for everyone, but I would say one in every 10 people in the queue were taking cider, and some of them were then coming back to try the other one once they'd got the beer in from the queue they were in. So I think we had a real opportunity like that, and I think it worked really well. We found, obviously, most people were there for the beer, but there's always plus ones, or for whom people like just as much beer as cider or cider as beer. So we obviously had them as a potential market. I felt we made some real progress because I think some lights went on for some people. And I've seen tweets and so forth from people saying, you know, highlights of the festival was that beer and that cider. And even saying that, and I don't even like cider. So that was a real, you know, things like that are great. And it's good to be challenged.
Indeed. And I've previously spoken about how I personally think that British cider has a bit of an image problem. Yourself and your ilk aside, we're talking about mass-produced cider and then scrumpy, which is how a lot of people see traditional British cider as being stuff that gives you a very strong stuff that gives you a hangover. So... And you've gone through a bit of a rebrand as well to try and update yourself, which looks great. So how does cider, as you see it, bring itself into this world like craft beer has? How does it have its craft beer moment?
Yes, that is a great question. I'm not sure I have any answer in particular, but what I think we have to do is learn from that you can create a dynamic category by just making drinks that get people excited. And yes, people can argue that in brewing it's an easier task because you can buy the ingredients and in a relatively short space of time, you can turn around a finished drink and get it on sale. And cider, as with wine, in the style that we make cider, it's a once a year proposition. And as Mark Tranter eloquently put it, depending on your age, you may only have another 20 attempts at making cider. And it was not a pointed remark from me, and I still will drink Burning Sky. But I may only have 20 more harvests and 20 more attempts at making the ultimate vintage cider. But if I was a brewer, I could do that within a year. So there are some sort of fundamental ways where we can't mimic beer, but we can make great cider, and we can make people aware of all that goes into making these great ciders. So we need to make more of the way that they match with food. I think that's a real potential that we don't make enough of. And we also need to celebrate the ingredients more, the varieties of apple, and what they bring to the to cider. And we need to make drinks of character. We must not hide behind levels of sweetness or degrees of carbonation or color or whatever. We must be bold and say this. These are drinks of character, and we should consume them with a degree of pleasure, but also knowledge and understanding, so that we get the most out of what we're drinking.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. Get your tickets for Uppers and Downers. We're going to be hosting Brewery Bavana and Burial Brewing alongside Counterculture for some fantastic case studies in coffee beers, including some mixed firm Saison, Sour, and Wild Ales, and a host of other experiments. And there's a lot more to announce in the coming weeks. On the site this week, we featured one of my favorite stories ever from Braden Kearney on the history and value proposition of Triple Carmelite as part of the underwritten series by Guinness called Coming to America. Its origin stories in our market are fascinating, including how it's been handled by the acquisition post AB InBev. Also, if you weren't already aware, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experience and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion. You should join. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. Visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.